verses 13 through 23. And again, are reminded of the nature of God's work in providential affairs, that there are no accidents and no coincidences as we consider what is going on in our world today. Esther chapter 2, beginning in verse 12. Now when the turn of each young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months, under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and cosmetics for the women. The young lady would go in to the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Shazgaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in again to the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. And when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, to his royal palace, in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known to her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. Please be seated. In 1980, my parents moved from Tucson, Arizona, where I was born and raised, to San Diego, California. My dad was in search of a job, really kind of putting his life back together after a very difficult time of early marriage and early in his life. And in the sprawling suburb of Mira Mesa, they just happened to run into a couple who had teens the same age as their children, us, who told them of a small church close to their house which had just hired a new youth pastor. They invited my parents to their home on a Wednesday evening, where that youth pastor was having his first meeting with the youth and to parents to let them know his plans for the coming year. There was maybe five families, maybe 10 youth who were there. It was that night when I was 14 years of age that I met a man named Rocky Wyatt, a man who would be instrumental in prompting me to go into ministry and with whom I still work in ministry today. See, life is filled mostly with mundane events that seem to have no particular importance in and of themselves. To the believer, however, every one of these small, boring events of life is a means of bringing glory to God as we direct our effort in living for his pleasure. When we make use of every moment in this way, we are testifying that there is no such thing as a meaningless activity, and we are able to be used of God to bring about his purposes in ways that we never would have imagined. So what we'll see this morning is that God is sovereign in all the events of men and empowers his people to live for his glory in such a way that even the most mundane of circumstances is used by him to carry out his sovereign plan. God is sovereign in all the events of men, and he empowers his people to live for his glory in such a way that even the most mundane of circumstances is used by him to carry out his sovereign plan. When we are faithful in the little things, we are in fact being faithful in the big things. Faithfulness in small is faithfulness in large. Now, remember the theme of the book of Esther. It was written to the Jews in exile who did not return to their homeland to demonstrate God's ongoing favor towards them and to provide the foundation really for the origin of a feast that came about, the Feast of Purim, to celebrate God's protection of his people. God uses ordinary people. This is kind of the theological theme of Esther. God uses ordinary people to accomplish his sovereign purposes and gives them power to be faithful in the face of seemingly impossible circumstances. This is what God has always done. He always provides his people with what they need to accomplish his work. And then the very simple theme is that God provides deliverance through faithful people, preservation through providence. Our timing in history is that the Jews have returned from 70 years of captivity. Zerubbabel has led the return, 536 BC. Ezra and Nehemiah will lead returns. We know this from our historical books that are we have in our Old Testament. Many Jews stayed behind in Persia, and really this book is written between the returns of Zerubbabel and Ezra, really between Esther chapter 6 and Esther chapter 7, to remind us that even those that were left behind, even those who stayed in Persia, God is still caring for his people. And really what will happen to them there has ramifications on what would happen to his people even in Jerusalem, those who had gone back to Israel, and that God is still working and is always working to bring preservation for his people, his ethnic people certainly, his ethnic chosen people, but also his spiritual people, that is us, the people of God. In chapter 1, we looked at the king's fateful banquet. We saw his prestigious identity, that he is the king of 127 provinces, his might, his power, but also his vast wealth and his ego. And we were reminded that King Ahasuerus is really us. He is exerting his power over this vast domain that he has. We seek to exert our power over whatever domain we have, no matter how small it might be. If our footprint is not 170 provinces, but maybe 1,000 square feet of our home, we will seek to exert our power there. That's who we are. And apart from Christ, we will dominate or seek to manipulate in ways that are displeasing and dishonoring to the Lord. So we look at a king like that, exerting his power in evil ways, and we're like, wow, how can he do that? We need to be careful to look at our own lives. Not that each of you is a Ahasuerus. I mean, as believers, we are not him. He did not love the true God. You do, most of you. And the prayer is that we would never even begin to live in ways that would approximate the things of the world. That's what we're reminded of. The Old Testament really helps us with that. As we look and see people dominated by evil, to understand that we are called to live lives that are entirely separate. Israel was called to live a separate existence. We, as the people of God, are also called to live in a manner that is separate from our culture. But it's not so much our dress or even so much the media. Obviously, the media and other things that we watch are to be different. It is the direction of our lives that is supposed to be different. It is our pleasures and our purposes that are to set us apart from the world. So we're not to look weird. That's not the idea. The idea is that we act weird. That people are like, what are you doing? Why would you live for that? Why would you not pursue the things that the world does? Why are you not pleased by all the things that please the world? Those are the things they ought to be asking you questions about, not strange quirks in your behavior or funny stuff that you wear. I mean, wear what you want, but that's not the issue. We are to draw people by the fact that we do not live for what they live for, and they ought to be stunned by that. And certainly in our political age, where men live, and I mean, have we not been reminded that political things rule the world? I mean, that's what the book of Esther is all about. It's all about politics. You've got a mighty, powerful king who does what he wants, and in that way is seeking to upend the people of God. So people live for that. That's really the highest level of what people live for. Their pleasure and power has lived out through the politics that they interact with. But we are not that people. We are not driven by politics. We're driven by the provision of Jesus. And we must remember that because the world has nowhere else to turn. Those things are most important to them because that is their highest appeal of authority. Politics and politicians rule everyone's life. We're not saying that's not true, but they don't rule the Christian's life. They don't rule our lives. They don't rule the life of the church. We live for our Lord in a political age. So these things are so important for us. And all the things that Ahasuerus is trying to do and that the political machinations that will go on in these next chapters will happen, God is sovereignly overseeing those things. And we are faithful to him in the midst of that so that his purposes are accomplished, but we do not get caught up in being dominated by the pursuit of political things. Now, in chapter 2, we have seen the king's fateful search, that he deposed Vashti in a fit of rage, drunken rage, and then he remembers this. Most likely, our narrative doesn't tell us this directly, but history tells us that in between chapter 1 and chapter 2, we have Ahasuerus trying to defeat Greece. He gets beaten back by the Greeks. He comes back to kind of sulk in his palace, and then he realizes, what have I done? I have no queen. And the people that help him, his ministers and attendants in his household are tired of his sulking around, says, look, you need a queen, and then they put together this entire process by which he can receive one. So we saw that he searches for a queen by kidnapping all of the beautiful women in his provinces, as many as he can find. He brings them in, and then he prepares them for a year, and then each one comes to him individually so that he might decide whether they please him or not. The one who pleases him the most becomes his queen. And I just was reminded again, this going in and out, so each of these women who goes into the king and comes back out, again, our society mimics this in nearly every way, unbelieving society. Men living for one-night stands, bringing in one woman after another. Women living for these things, amazingly enough. This is what our world is dominated by. So the things that we are discussing here in the Bible are eminently practical to us in the world around us. Now, Christians don't live that way, but you live in a world where everyone else does. Sexual things dominate our culture and have always done so. We were seeing that back then. If you have the most power, you are able to provide yourself the most sexual pleasure. That was the idea. That's never been different. And so when we kind of put our blinders on and pretend that these things don't exist, and it's like, well, those aren't spiritual things. They are, of course, spiritual things. Physical intimacy and the nature of marriage, all of these things which have been brought to us by our text. I mean, the whole idea of how a man responds to a woman in marriage. I mean, built into the text here because they're built into the fabric of everyday life. These are real things. And in fact, marriage and human relationships do what? They dominate all of our thinking in our lives. If you're not married, you want to be. If you are married, sometimes you don't want to be. All right, when you move to the time of your life where you get older, you're still thinking through and working your way through the relationships that dictate your life. So it seemed good, before we get onto our outline, to kind of give you the sermon before the sermon. By way of review, one of the few things we haven't really talked about directly is the nature of physical intimacy, but it is all over in chapter 2. This king is misusing and abusing intimacy in marriage. Sexual pleasure is what drives him. Instead of one man and one woman together for life, he has multiple women and over and over. We'll see again in our text today that it would appear he has a second virgin contest and brings in a whole nother group of virgins, perhaps to find someone else to please him. This is a man dominated by his pleasure in this way. But as I said, our world is. So I wanted to take just a few moments. So maybe if you want to flip your outline over on the back, I'd like to talk a little bit about intimacy in marriage. And you guys, don't start sweating. We have children in here today. That's not the issue as far as talking about the specifics. But if I were to overlook this topic of how important physical intimacy is, and particularly in relationship to marriage, I think I would do a disservice to our congregation. Physical intimacy in marriage is vital, and it is twisted beyond recognition by our world, so that rarely do we have any understanding of how these things work. I had the precious privilege of performing a marriage yesterday. It's one of the sweetest things I do as a minister of the gospel, as I get to help people enter into a lifelong relationship. I got to do the premarital counseling. We spend 10, 15 weeks talking through the issues of marriage, and it's not like I ignore then the whole issue of physical intimacy. Like somehow that doesn't matter. Every married couple in here knows that it does, and every non-married couple or non-married person understands that the ideas of physical intimacy drive much of your thinking and much of your problems, many of your problems. So it is essential that we have an understanding of what the nature of physical intimacy, sexual intimacy in marriage is. And I just want to remind you of a few things. Physical intimacy is essential to guard before marriage. God has prescribed the only place for physical intimacy to be engaged in, and that is in marriage, period. And although that is obvious for us, or should be, as Christians, it is not obvious, unfortunately, seemingly, to the evangelical world even, that you can engage in all kinds of debauchery, even as a Christian, and somehow think that that's God's plan for marriage. Each wedding ceremony that I do, very purposely, we get to the end, and there's a kiss at the end. Now, why do you think there's a kiss at the end of a marriage ceremony? That is an implication, or it is a presentation of the physical intimacy that is part of the one flesh bond. That's why you have one. Kissing is that. It's kind of the visual picture that you can give of the oneness that will be entered into that evening or throughout that week as the physical nature of marriage is expressed. And that's not unimportant. And so I take the time each time to both challenge and encourage those who are standing before me of their pursuit encourage them for their pursuit of purity. Because when we do our premarital counseling, first question, are you involved physically? If you are, stop. And if you don't stop, I will not do your counseling and I will not do your marriage. So you may be that you have failed all the way up until this time, but if you continue to fail for these next 20 weeks, I won't marry you. because it is a travesty and a violation of what God intends in marriage for you to be taking that privilege beforehand. And I say that before we do the kiss, which is, look, thank you for taking this time, either all along the way, if the Lord has been gracious and you've not engaged in physical intimacy at all, or at least during this time when you were preparing for marriage that you said, oh, we will stop sinning and do what is right. And so I promote that both for the couple that's standing before me and then to those who are listening. It's important. We need to do more of that. Marriage is to be about purity. And I understand there's been all kinds of upheaval in these days with Josh Harris abandoning the faith, and he's the guy that wrote, you know, I Kiss Dating Goodbye, and a castigation of purity culture. We, you know, people talking about how important it was to not, you know, they're going to wear rings about not having sexual intimacy before marriage. All right, I understand maybe the culture was bad. Maybe there was kind of a self-righteousness that was engaged in that. I mean, as a youth pastor growing up in all that. But the push for purity, as though that somehow is something that is to be repudiated now? Purity culture is what Christians are all about. Not the bad portions of that, not the pressures. Hey, if as long as you're pure before marriage, your marriage will be perfect and wonderful and you'll find just the right person. It's not true. But being pure before marriage is certainly the one way that you would enter into a marriage that is, or enter into with the best possible opportunities for physical intimacy. Not that God can't and doesn't bless and encourage and strengthen and build those who have failed in multiple ways in that area. He does. He's a God of grace and forgiveness. And yet the idea that we wouldn't seek that we wouldn't desire to have those who are entering into marriage be pure and those within marriage to remain pure is simply unbiblical. Hebrews 13:4. Marriage is to be held in honor among all. The marriage bed is to be undefiled. For fornicators, that is those who have sexual relations outside of marriage, and adulterers, those who within marriage cheat on their spouses, fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. I'm not making that up. I didn't say that. God says that. Does he forgive? Yes. For believers who repent and confess of these things, of course he does. Does he wash them clean through his forgiveness? Of course. But there is a judgment involved for believers or unbelievers when it comes to sinning in this way. So the challenge would be this morning, if you are, stop. And if you are playing with these things as a married person, the judgment of God is close. It is close. And you need to take these things very seriously. Essential. It is essential to guard physical intimacy before marriage. Physical intimacy is an essential part of being one flesh. There's certainly more to the one flesh union than the physical union. But that physicality, where possible, that is, some marriages precluded on the basis of physical issues that might be involved, but the vast majority, where it is possible, physicality is a fundamental part of the joining of man and wife. Galatians 2:24. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. The man and his wife were naked, and they were not ashamed. That's all there in the Bible. And important for us to understand, there was a purity of sexual relationship before the fall, and it is to be kept pure in marriage after the fall. Of course, the one flesh union is essential for procreation. God's design is for a husband and wife to engage in physical intimacy in order to have children. Not every couple can have children. I understand that. And it can be a cause of great just anxiety and pain when children are not possible. But it doesn't remove the fact that that is one of the primary goals of marriage, is to engage in physical intimacy, to have children. And the fact that science has developed ways to facilitate having children apart from a direct one-flesh connection is in no way meant to replace intimacy as a means of replicating the human race. The ridiculous picture on our front page, you know, on some of the news things of our the man in our government who has another man as his husband, and they have these two babies, and they're sitting on a hospital bed. I mean, this is junior high stuff, right? That can't happen. There was no need for a hospital bed. No man has a baby, and it's really sad. I mean, to think that the intellectual nature of, and really moral nature of, where we've devolved is that sort of thing would even be possible. Look at that going, somehow indicating that these men had a baby. I mean, again, not two-year-olds, maybe second graders, third graders, understand that that's not possible, and yet we're trumpeting that as that somehow this happened. I understand that's ridiculous. I understand you're looking at that going, how can I trust anybody that would think that is true? I get it, particularly in sexual matters. They can't even figure out that men can't have babies. And I'm not making fun of the people or those men. I'm just simply saying that's ridiculous. And that's not how babies happen. And that's not how it was designed that they would come marriage is. And the physical intimacy of marriage, the beauty of that union, then being used by God to provide children, is a sacred and beautiful thing, and it needs not to be forgotten by us. And so we need to continue to consider and to teach and to help our young people also understand these things. Physical intimacy in marriage, Genesis 4:1, if you want a Bible verse for the fact that physical intimacy is essential for procreation. Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived, and she gave birth to Cain, and she said, I have gotten a man-child, I love this, with the help of the Lord. It is God who makes provision in these ways. Physical intimacy is essential for protection against temptation. The temptations towards immorality in our world are very strong. Regular mutual intimacy by a man and wife in marriage is a means by which marriage remains strong, and it helps mitigate the temptation for the misuse of our sexuality. Now hear me. This is true for both husband and wife, not just the husband. It isn't simply that the man and wife should engage in physical intimacy so that the man doesn't look at pornography. That's ridiculous. And men who manipulate their wife in that way, I've got no choice but to do this unless we have physical intimacy. It's ridiculous. The Bible's clear, 1 Corinthians 7:5, that both men and women are in danger of temptation if there is not regular, where it is possible, physical intimacy. 1 Corinthians 7:5. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Come together again so that Satan will not tempt you all, both of you, not just the men, because of your lack of self-control. Women wrestle in different ways generally when it comes to temptations to misuse their sexuality, but they struggle, and a lack of marital intimacy between man and a wife in marriage leads to both of their struggles with temptations, just simply in different ways. And you need to understand that both men and women need to understand. It's not a male issue. It is male and female, because physical intimacy is male and female, both. Now, it is also essential, physical intimacy is essential as a portrayal of Christ's intimacy with his church. That is, again, it's just a picture, and you're thinking, well, nobody sees the picture except the man and the wife. Yep. When a man and a wife do not engage in physical intimacy, again, where possible, as if there are other problems that keep from that, that's, again, the Lord knows those things. But where it is possible, if they do not, they themselves are tearing at the fabric of their marriage in its representation of the intimacy that Christ has with his church. You cannot play with physical intimacy saying it just doesn't matter or it's not important. That was the whole issue in Corinth. We're saying, look, physical intimacy is just a physical thing. Stomach for the food, food for the stomach. It's no big deal. Say, no, sexual intimacy is not that way. You have to do your study. Go back to, we did several conferences on the nature of purity, both for men and women. It is to be a picture to the husband and wife regularly of Christ's intimacy with them. It's a picture only. It's not some kind of ontological, physical thing that's happening as far as with Christ. But the issue is that picture remains vital for men and for women. And it is necessary that they both are engaged in that kind of intimacy so that their marriage continues to make that portrayal. 1 Corinthians 6:13, for the stomach, this is what the Corinthians were saying, food is for the stomach and the stomach for food, but God will do away with both of them, yet the body is not for immorality but for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. Proper engagement of physical intimacy in marriage honors the Lord. It's part of the picture of Christ in the church that marriage is to be. Physical intimacy then is to be kept in proper perspective. It is not to become more important than it is. The world worships physical intimacy in that sense. It is their idol. And yet, physical intimacy is not to be made less important than it is. It's no big deal. We don't need to engage in this. This is somehow pagan or physically undesirable, or people that desire physical intimacy are somehow weirdos. No, this is what God built us for. He built the desire. He built marriage in light of how that physical intimacy could be carried out. All of that in light of his knowledge, his foresight of what Christ in the church would be and how we would exemplify that. None of this is by accident, including physical desires towards intimacy. It's not just you believe in evolutionary philosophy and science if you somehow think that physical intimacy and the desires for it were something that just how arises, it just arises out of the physicality of human beings without God having purposely built it there. And therefore, it is essential for every couple to think rightly about physical intimacy. Wherever you are in the health of your physical relationship, consider your need to improve this. I've been doing marriage counseling for 35 years. I've rarely found a marriage in which there are not some areas to work through in this. And understand that when you're young, there are issues. As you get older, there are issues. When you move into older age and you're married, there are issues. All kinds of things to be worked on. And the nature of how intimate this is makes it very difficult to discuss. So that is my challenge to you in my sermon before the sermon, is that you would be very careful in considering these issues, not setting them aside. Again, both as singles and as married, so that you would behave wisely in these ways. Where there are patterns of anger, indifference, and selfishness, you need to change them. Not just, this is how it is, this is how it's always been. Where you can and as you can, you need to work on change. You need to do the hard work of communicating specifically about your successes and hurts in this area. And if you cannot communicate about it, you are in serious trouble, and you need to sit with someone that can help you communicate. If this particular topic has become taboo in your marriage, you just can't talk about it because there's too much hurt, too many things that have gone on, you have got to sit down with someone. Because I understand you can't just sit down and say, oh, let's have a discussion this afternoon. And there are years of hurt and bitterness that are built into this relationship, and to even mention it causes instant conflagration, instant anger. You're going to have to sit with someone. You may not continue to allow that to be in your marriage because you are harming the nature of your marriage's portrayal of Christ and the church. This is not just a physical issue. That's no big deal. We're going to be spiritual. We'll go to church. We'll look good. We'll do ministry. We'll do all these other things. But this is just a physical thing. It isn't just a physical thing. You need to seek counsel for help if things are difficult. And you need to read some good books. Maybe one good book. And so write this one down, please, if you would. It's called Sex and the Supremacy of Christ. Sex and the Supremacy of Christ. It is edited by John Piper. He did not write everything that is in it. My assignment would be for every single person in the congregation, well, of, you know, if you're college age, I would say, and over, to read that book. And for couples to say, we're going to commit to sitting down, particularly the first two chapters, which place the nature of physical intimacy within the realm of God's plan and how he's built that to please and honor him, which I talk to couples who have absolutely no idea. They have no idea of where physical intimacy fits in God's plan for marriage and in the picture of Christ in the church. They know marriage is supposed to be that, but they have no idea where their physical intimacy fits, as though it's somehow a lesser thing or God didn't design it. You need to know. And if you don't, then I would encourage you to read that. If you're a single, you need to read and understand what God's plan for physical intimacy is so that you don't misuse it. Unfortunately, we don't have any on the book table. That's my fault because I forgot to tell anybody to get them. But you can get them. You can order it yourself. You can get it on Kindle. You can do whatever you need. And that's not a minor challenge. It's a major one. Because our world, again, is awash in sexual immorality. And it is awash in failed marriages. It's not driven simply by the problems with physical intimacy, because that's largely a symptom. Where there's physical intimacy problems, it means that there's a lack of love, a lack of care, generally, a lack of concern, a lack of respect, a series of things. And yet, these things are ruining marriages, and they are portraying to our culture that Christians can't understand and live in these areas. If anyone should be healthy sexually, it ought to be Christians, because God built this for us. And yet the misuse of it is rampant in the church, from pornography to everything else. So maybe I'm praying that these things will help. Now again, my encouragement is I love the strong marriages of our church. I love those who are working on these areas. I work with a variety of those who are actively pursuing doing what is right and good in this area. So congratulations for that. But there's work to be done. And your children need to see married couples. Your children need to see a healthy understanding of sexuality. You need to talk about it rightly. Your love for your spouse needs to be properly displayed to them. And you need to carefully talk through these things. I can't tell you, again, how many people that I talk to as we reach the end of the premarital counseling. And I say, look, do you have someone to talk to about the nature of the wedding night? As though that were something that shouldn't be talked about. As though that were something that someone shouldn't say, look, here's how things will play out. Here's how you can honor Christ in this. And half of them say, I don't have anybody to talk to. Their parents included. And so these things need to be discussed. They need to be worked through. Obviously, they're much on my mind. But again, I want you to look back at the text. Are they not there? This king who comes in, or these women go in and out and in and out and in and out. His so-called marriage to them. They're all legally married to him. All of these women. And he has the rights, as it were, physical rights with them. It's all right here in the text. This is what the world loves to do, abuse, harm, and destroy God's beauty of physical intimacy. And we have to be so careful that we don't join them. We don't stand at a distance. How can the world do this? And yet our own sexual lives are rampant with problems. We are created to be sexual beings. That is who we are. And therefore, we need to handle this properly. Now to sermon number two. The king's faithful deliverance. So you can turn your outline back over. So as the king has finished with his audition and he has gained a queen, fascinatingly in our text, we'll jump right back into our text, it is again highlighted, I believe, his insatiable appetite when it comes to these things. Verse 19 says, when the virgins were gathered together the second time. Now, nobody really knows exactly what's going on there. Every commentator has a different thought. It could be the most, I guess, maybe the simplest thing, it could possibly refer to the fact that, okay, the virgins being gathered a second time was the ones that had gone in and the ones that came out and were now under the care of Shazgaz with the concubines. But the language doesn't really indicate that somehow he's referring back to what happened to the women who went into the king and came back out. And it's like, so why would the author put this here? It seems likely that King Ahasuerus gathered another group of virgins. And he's like, well, that was great. I loved that year, and so we'll do that again, and maybe to keep the queen on her toes. It's hard to know. Regardless, the nature of this king and his relationship to physical intimacy and to women is horribly harmful. But when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate. I think the idea is we've had a passage of time. Esther is now the queen. Whatever this gathering of the virgins is, it's happened again. And now we have a picture of where Mordecai will really begin his fateful deliverance of the king. He is sitting in the king's gate. Now, this is code words, essentially. It's not just sitting around, watching people come and go, like people watching at Walmart. You go to Westtown Mall, and you're like, I'm sitting in the gate. No, sitting in the gate is code words for he was most likely a lower-level official in the king's court, because the king's gate, or really the gate of a city, was generally the place where the king conducted business. It was kind of the administrative facilities. It was like the town hall. So you go down here to Maryville City Hall, and it would be like sitting in that building. In fact, there has been discovered in the gate, or around the gate area of Susa, a 13,000 square foot gatehouse, right? Which is where they would have this kind of work. Now, I would hold, some would say, well, see, Esther becomes queen, and Mordecai gets elevated to a position where he now has kind of a court position. I would hold that Mordecai already had this position. Why? Because we already know that he's got some kind of connection into the very harem of the king, which is a big deal. He was able to walk back and forth. So he wasn't sitting at the gate when Esther was in the harem because he was concerned. So he goes from sitting at the gate, and our text tells us he was walking back and forth before the harem to find out how she was doing. Now that she's done, she's the queen, he goes back, as it were, and sits down. He goes back. The text focuses on his administrative abilities. By the way, I don't think the only thing he did all day long was walk back and forth to see how Esther was doing. He got up from the king's gate where he was. He went and walked back and forth. But he had some kind of connection in the harem, most likely because he was already some sort of government official. Again, I think that's evident because his connections are deep. He is able to ferret out, or has an information source that reveals to him this plot against the king, which was at the highest levels, as we will see. Right? Those who were very close to the king were engaged in the plot, and Mordecai finds out about it. So it just gives us a time reference. The virgins, for whatever reason or whatever is going on, are gathered again. Mordecai is sitting in the king's gate. He is conducting business for the king. And notice again what the text mentions. So we're seeing some of these themes over and over. So at verse 20, so he's sitting in the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred. By not yet, kind of some foreshadowing there, right? She's going to, and it will be very important when she does. She's not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. Now, why would the author mention this? Because he is again bringing back to us Esther's character. That she, as she was really the child, the daughter, remember, Mordecai brought her into his family. They were cousins, yes, but she came in essentially with he as dad and her as daughter. He was raising her as his own daughter, and she was rightfully, biblically, coming underneath his instruction. And the idea here is that even when she comes out from under that, she continues to follow his directives because she respects him. It is no longer necessary for a woman out from underneath the direct work of her parents living in the home to have to obey, in the sense of Ephesians 6, what her parents say. But I think it is clear here that what our author is telling us is that she was obedient when she was in the home. That's the biblical directive. And then as she comes out, see, there's no reason for her to cast that aside. And I would give that advice to my young people here. When you come out from underneath your parents, it's not as though then, say, you know, you're living in your own home, or even when you've gotten married, you're not required to obey them. But why cast aside good advice they've given to you unless there's some good reason to do that? You don't just say, I don't care about my parents anymore. I don't respect them anymore. I'm just going to cast aside everything they taught me. So I think the picture here is that what the author is giving us is that Esther remains respectful. She remains humble. She remains willing to receive instruction where it is good and right. And that is a good lesson for all of us, that we remain in those ways, that the people who have given us instruction over time are ones that we should carefully consider and be very slow to get rid of or to step out from underneath good instruction that we've been given. Ephesians 6:1, you know the text, of course. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. It's fascinating how we have that fleshed out in this text. Esther was obedient. She came underneath her father, as it were, her adopted father, Mordecai. And as she does so, she gains principles, which as she moves then into becoming the queen, she does not yet reveal who she is based on a respect for his instruction. And that actually saves her life and saves the life of all of the Jews. It goes well with her, and she lives long on the earth. Because that's what that means. It doesn't mean you're going to live to be 150. It means that your life will be fruitful and that God will enable you to accomplish the work he's given when you learn what it means to come underneath the authority of your parents when you're in the home. The worst thing you could ever do, young people, is somehow think that by abandoning your parents' instructions early, rebelling against them as the world tells you to do, that that will actually give you a greater ability to live in the world because you're not being dominated by your parents. If you don't learn how to come underneath their authority, you don't learn how to come underneath anyone's authority, and most specifically, you don't learn how to come underneath God's authority, and it will not go well with you. Talk to anyone in this room who rebelled against their parents and ask them how well that went for them and how well those kinds of principles enabled them to walk in this world and to love God, and they will tell you that it was harmful in every way. So this is it's a beautiful picture of what this looks like. Someone obeys in the home, and then they come out. She continues to do what's right, and the Lord uses that ongoing respect to save her and to save her people. So the author gives us this information. He pauses the whole narrative and says, oh, she still hasn't told her identity, because that's what she was in practice of coming underneath Mordecai when she was in the home, and she's choosing to do that now because that is seems to be the best thing. It's the respectful thing to do. So that is, if you want our outline, Mordecai discovers the plot, Mordecai's position, some sort of official in the king's hierarchy, sitting in the gate, accomplishing his work with Esther. Now Esther as the queen, elevated above him. Isn't that fascinating? This little orphan girl that he took in is now above him. She is now second, as it were, in the kingdom, and he still remains a minor official at the king's gate. Mordecai's information then, in those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, we're told again, more repetition. He's in the gate, Esther's this, oh, he's in the gate. Right? He is this official, he has a position in which he can learn these things. When he was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, right? They come running onto the scene, these two guys, and they go running off the scene very quickly. They're dragged off the scene, never to be heard of again. Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials, from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So this door guarding, as best we understand, it is those that actually stood guard over the king's personal apartment. That is, when he went in to go to bed, they were the ones that closed the door, locked it, and kept anyone from coming in. This is about as close as you could possibly get to the king. You are protecting him while he is asleep. And so it would have been a place of tremendous responsibility and a place of tremendous vulnerability, because anyone who wanted to get at the king was going to come through you. And so constant bribes, constant, hey, we got this plot against the king. If you'll let us in, we'll kill the king. No one will ever know, whatever it might be. Guys, you know, you understand at least a little bit. You've seen your History Channel or whatever. Don't believe too much of that stuff. But as you watch some of that, and you grew up in history class where kings didn't just come to the throne and there's like, you know, kick back for a while, I'm on the throne. No, people were trying to take them off the throne the moment they got there for the entire time. If they lasted 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, they were doing really good. And a guy like Nebuchadnezzar, who lasts until he dies, essentially, I mean, that never happened. Just look at the history of Israel. I mean, you work your way into the second part of the kings of Israel on the northern side, the 10 tribes. They're lasting a couple of months before they get killed. This is God's chosen people. You can imagine what it was like, the dog-eat-dog nature of trying to stay alive as King Ahasuerus. So these two dudes, all right, are really important to him, Bigthan and Teresh, and he needs to keep them close to him. Well, something happened. They got mad. Again, anger plays in. Should I go over my anger sermon again? I'm going to leave it off. I'm going to back off on you. All right? They get mad. They made a really bad decision. We're going to kill the king. That's a great idea. Almost as good as bringing Vashti into a bunch of drunk people. This is great. We're going to kill the king. Who knows why? Maybe they liked Vashti. Maybe they were mad because he lost to the Greeks. Could be anything. He could have insulted them on the way in the room. I mean, who knows? They're mad. So they hatched the plot. Now, I think these two guys were about as dumb as rocks. All right? Because somehow a guy like Mordecai gets this figured out. And it's true. I mean, if you're going to plot against the king, you ought to be smart enough not to tell anybody else. But of course, as it always happens, somebody's got to talk. They're probably like, we're going to kill the king. They bragged to somebody, or they took the wrong person into their confidence. Right? Whoever maybe was bribing them, maybe there are bigger powers at play. Other people who are saying, look, if you just do this, then we'll put this. That's most likely what's happening. You do this, you let us in, and we'll let, you know, we'll let someone else get on the throne. But our text tells us it's them. They got mad. So these two guys are going to, we're taking the king out. Right? We can get this done. Well, they couldn't. Right? So that's Mordecai's information. They became angry. They sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Mordecai's message, the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told the queen. So he's sitting in the gate. He's got his streams of information. Right? He already knows how to. He's got connection to the harem, and if I had to guess, that's where this rumor or that's where this plot came through. Somehow it comes through the harem. Right, with all the women involved there and all the high-level officials there, I think somehow it comes through there, filters through. The word in the harem is that Bigthan and Teresh are mad and that they're going for the king, and Mordecai hears about this. Right, so he gets the stream of information, and he then immediately passes it on to the queen. Well, why? I mean, why not let Ahasuerus die? Who cares? Because Mordecai is employed by Ahasuerus. We have another faithful man. This is boss. Right? When someone's going to kill the boss, you tell the boss. You're like, well, wait a minute. I mean, I work at Chick-fil-A, and people hate the managers all the time. They're not going to kill them. And I just join in with that. And I join in with all the scuttlebutt at work, and everybody hates the boss, and everybody wants to take him down, and I join in because he's a bad boss. Ahasuerus was a good king. Right? Certainly didn't do godly things. Yet this was Mordecai's job. One of the things, best things you will ever learn as an employee is that you are there, as long as you choose to be an employee there, you are there for the benefit of your employer, not just you. And when things are going down around you, you are defending him. Yeah, and again, or her, on the basis of the fact that they're your employer. Now, if they do have done wrong things, you're like, they didn't really do wrong things. But you do not join in all of that. I mean, I had to tell this to my son as he entered into his work life. I had to tell this to my daughter as she's entered into it. You do not join the scuttlebutt going on everywhere. Everyone hates their employer. If I had a dime for everyone who complained against the people over them, I would be a billionaire. Because everybody does. It's what the world does. Yes, I'm making an application here, but it is clear that Mordecai says what? I mean, he says, hey, they're trying to kill my boss. I'm not going to let that go down. He's a Jew with this pagan king. He says, I'm going to tell him so that he does not die. You know the verses, Colossians 3:23, whatever you do, do your work heartily as to the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It's the Lord Christ whom you serve, for he who does wrong, that is in the workplace, will receive the consequences of the wrong that he has done, and that without partiality. You're going to gripe against the boss. You're going to, you know, go against what they say. You get demoted. You get fired. You get whatever. That's on you. That's on you totally, because the Lord brought that. So to be kind, to be gracious, to lift up your boss, your job is to make him look good in every way possible. Again, this is a pagan, gross king. Think about Daniel. who lived with all of those pagan kings, or Nebuchadnezzar first, and then Cyrus a bit, Darius. So he lives with them for a brief period of time, and yet he serves them and honors them as those who were over him. We've forgotten that. We don't like that. We're Americans, right? So we don't have to do any of that. We don't have to honor our employers. We don't have to do any of that. We can do what we want. That's not what the Bible says. You're not to do immoral things. I get that. You're not allowed to ever yield when it comes to immoral stuff. But other than that, support, encourage, build. And if you are part of the one who's trying to take down your employers, God will judge you. I didn't make it up. That's what Colossians says. Maybe that's the more challenging thing for this morning. I can't tell you how many men who have been helped, benefited, and blessed by learning how to be a blessing to their employers, to live properly within their work so that they can honor and please the Lord, and they watch the Lord bring blessing to their work that has never happened before. Never happened. That's my prayer. Well, Mordecai is a faithful employee, as it were, and he does the best thing for his boss. He informs Esther. He doesn't have a stream directly to the king. He informs Esther. Then Esther informs the king of the plot. That's B. So Esther informs the king. So back into our text in verse 22, end of it. Esther informed the king, I love this, in Mordecai's name. That's really important. Because if the king doesn't know that Mordecai did this, then the majority of what happens later on with Haman's fall doesn't happen. If he thinks Esther did it and Mordecai has no place in this particular picture, if she erases him out of her own ego, hey, I'm the queen. Hey, guess what, king? Someone's trying to kill you. I found this out. I figured this out. And so I'm going to tell you about this plot. So look at me. I'm great. I figured it out. I'm saving you, which is what any secular person would do. And it's what people do in the workplace all the time. You come up with a good idea. You present it to you know, so-and-so who presents it to the next higher up. And he says, it's my idea, right? Probably half of you, if not more, have had that happen to you. Happens all the time. Well, Esther doesn't stoop to that. She says, look, Mordecai told me this, and so you need to know that this is going on. As we will see, that's what gets written down in the book, is that Mordecai was the one who uncovered the plot so that later on in the story, when the king reads his, goes back through his annals, he finds out, oh, Mordecai did this, not Esther. Really important. By the way, give credit where credit is due. Another sub-application, but it's not a minor application. All kinds of Old Testament texts that point to the fact that the individuals within the governmental systems didn't take glory. Remember Joseph? When Pharaoh says, hey, you have the spirit of the holy gods inside of you, and so you can do these things. He goes, it's not me. God is the one who has enabled me to know these things. Daniel was the same way. We're never going to say, wow, that's incredible. You have the ability to interpret dreams. He says, I don't, God does. Again, I think we see pointed to the providence of God here, but this ability to be humble, to give credit where credit is due, is what Christians do. Humility matters. And your ability not to steal things or take things or promote yourself where it's inappropriate is part of the mundane work, as it were, the boring work that God does. This is just another day sitting at the king's gate, hearing some information. Now, it's pretty big information, but passing it along and just each person acting out of character that they have built over time. Mordecai didn't all of a sudden decide to be a good employee, as it were. Esther didn't all of a sudden decide to be humble and give Mordecai credit where credit was due. That was part of her character. Remember, God's providence flows through your character that he has enabled to be built in you as you have worked over time through the Spirit of God and cultivated those things. God doesn't work apart from your character, as it were. We see that being enacted in these daily, moment-by-moment decisions that these people are making, that Esther and Mordecai and others are making. Colossians 3:12, as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another, forgiving each other, whoever is complaining against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Do you think that living in the church, if you do not cultivate these kinds of characteristics, that when something happens where there's a difficulty, where you have to deal with a problem in the church, or you have to respond to a crisis, that you're going to do so humbly and graciously if you haven't been building that character over time? The answer is no, you won't. And you'll be angry and bitter and vicious and backbiting and all those things that the world is. You've got to build this. And you build it over time because the church is full of stresses and strains, just as the world is, again, by way of application into the church. Your ability to live with the people of this church and walk and work through the difficulties that happen here consider the stresses and strains we face even now as a church and in the society. You will never be able to walk through those things wisely and well if you haven't been cultivating this kind of character, and or if when someone then confronts you about not having that kind of character, that you don't respond to them. You must. The church is not about coming with your same character and never being molded and shaped. Hey, this is who I am. This is what I do. This is how I respond. The church is about being molded and shaped when people confront you and say, why are you like that? And why did you respond that way? And why do you have that anger? And why does this pride seem to be driving your life? We have to respond to those things. Now, Ahasuerus ends the plot. This ends quickly. All right, this one's over, all right, really fast. Now, when the plot was investigated, it's interesting. Again, it was investigated. Mordecai wasn't a high enough up official that they would simply say, oh, Mordecai said it. Boom, we're doing it. They investigated. Are these two guys part of that? I imagine they were clapped in irons first and then investigated a little bit. So they didn't just kill him right off the bat, which is, I guess, some benefit. So it was investigated and found to be so. They were both hanged on the gallows. Now, the Hebrew here reads hanged on a tree. It's probably, don't think rope, you know, up there and they get this rope and the noose. Probably impaled on a stake is a better way to take this. It would be up high somewhere, a platform somewhere, and then they would be, literally that stake would either be shoved through them or they would be shoved on top of the pointed stake and left there for everybody to see. There's a little foreshadowing, by the way. These two guys are not the last people in this narrative to whom this will happen. But this was the Persians' delight. They loved to kill people this way. Almost a form of crucifixion. I don't think it's the normal form as the Romans finally worked its way through, right? But don't think, right, the little rope noose, and it's not that, right? Probably jammed down upon some kind of wooden post for everyone to see, stuck to it. It stuck through them. Not pretty. These were not pretty people. They didn't care about the aesthetics of capital punishment, right? They simply did what they wanted. So Ahasuerus ends the plot. The plotters are hanged, as it were, probably impaled would be better. And then fascinatingly enough, and I can leave you with this morning, the event was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. Isn't that fascinating? We have a book of Chronicles in the Bible. It's not these Chronicles, but it's the Chronicles of what went on in the kingdom. That's what our book of Chronicles is about, the kings of Israel. Well, guys, there was an intricate and elaborate system of recording everything that went on in the kingdom because it was important. You had to look back and see who did what, when did they do it, why did they do it, so you could figure out the next things that you were supposed to do. That's always been true. And all the documents we have now and emails that come out, right, no email server here. Right, this was hard, you know, it was written down on actual pages of a book, which is a little more secure, actually, than a billion emails and texts that are flying around, which are never secure. Even your Snapchats are not secure, but that's something for another day. Book of Chronicles, King's Presence, written down. This is really important. Why? Because later on, the king is going to get bored, and he's going to flip through this record. He's going to go, oh, I'm just reading through here. A couple years ago, this thing went on. And, oh, Mordecai's name. So you'll have to, you know, you can do your homework. You can figure out how all that's going to work. But it is fascinating. A couple things are fascinating here. It's written in the Chronicles of the King's Presence, and nothing happens. It's meant to save the king. And actually, the Persians were well known for rewarding those who helped them out. Right? Often, Herodotus, again, our Greek historian, reveals to us that the Persian kings would send people around during battles to literally just chronicle things that people did well. Because, of course, it benefits you if you properly bribe or properly give rewards to the people who do well for you, then more people want to do well for you. So they were big about that. Look, you do good for me, I'll do good for you so you don't kill me. That's the idea. Well, he forgets. Or he doesn't. Why? Providential. Even his lack of doing this means that later on he'll find out that he didn't do anything, and then he'll seek to benefit Mordecai. That's going to be a big deal. So even in his omission, what the king does not do, divinely moved to not do anything beneficial for Mordecai, even that, I mean, seemingly totally inconsequential detail, which goes against the character even of this king, most likely, is part of God's providence. Do you see how God uses everything and how you would never know ahead of time any of that? Please don't take these sermons and start analyzing your life to think, ooh, now this, you know, I'm changing some diapers today. I wonder how that's going to change the kingdom tomorrow. Well, it's going to be cleaner. It's going to smell better, your kingdom. But don't try to figure that stuff out. That's not what I'm talking about with providence. You don't know what God is doing. You just be faithful in changing the diaper. and going into work and stopping your complaints against your employer and your bad behavior on the basis of things that you don't like. And then you just wait to see what God will do. And you might never know anything. If we hadn't, again, had Esther revealed to us, we wouldn't have any idea that any of this was valuable. How many other people were doing faithful things all during this time that we'll never hear about? So don't try to figure out providence. Just be faithful and know that God is going to use it. By the way, by way of application and final thought, is God never forgets what you've done for him, ever. The king did. He wrote it down. God writes everything down. It's all in his books, every single one, his mind. He's not physically writing it anywhere. He knows everything you've ever done, everything you've ever said, everything you've ever thought, everything you've ever wanted to do, every motivation you ever had. He knows and remembers for eternity. And the beautiful thing about it is God rewards every single thing that was done for him, every one of them. I know most of the time with this kind of thing, we focus on what you've done wrong. God knows. But here we have something done rightly that wasn't rewarded. You need to understand that as a believer, no good thing you have ever done, that is good thing, empowered by God, for the glory of God, according to the word of God, no good thing you've ever done will go unrewarded by a holy God. Not one. And you do hundreds of them every day if you're a Christian. Hundreds of them. Hebrews 6:10. For God is not unjust so as to forget your work and the love which you have shown towards his name in having ministered and in still ministering to the saints. As we desire that each one of you show the same diligence so as to realize the full assurance of hope until the end. Well, King Ahasuerus forgot. Well, God never forgets, and he is even now bringing blessings that come from obedience. But bigger picture is that when you stand before him, 2 Corinthians 5:9, we have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to him, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. And I know, again, we focus mostly on the bad, and you're like, I'm going to scare you into wanting to do good things because, you know, you'll get there and God's going to, you know, take into account your bad things. That's true. And I believe there's going to be a feeling of and a moment of a time of shame. But that's not my focus this morning. The focus this morning is there's going to be delight in every good thing you did. Why? Because the delight in your rewards are the fact that you were able to honor Christ by his own power and glory. You don't get the credit for those rewards, but you do get the rewards. And they are there to honor Christ. And every good reward you receive for the good things you did redounds to his glory. Every shameful thing that you ever did steals from it. Not for eternity. You're not going to cry over your, you know, your foolish mistakes for all of eternity, but you are going to benefit from your reward for all of eternity. Isn't that sweet? The shame gone in a moment? Even for believers, there will be that at the judgment seat of Christ. But then joy in the reward of God because it delighted the heart of Christ. So a couple thoughts as we finish. Concerning sermon number one, are you aware of and carefully pursuing God's plan for physical intimacy, either by joyfully abstaining before marriage or joyfully engaging in marriage? Second, are you actively pursuing spiritual excellence? Now to second sermon, are you actively pursuing spiritual excellence in whatever occupation the Lord has given you, looking for opportunities to bless your employer and use your influence for Christ regardless of how good the organization you work for is? You work for it. You had the privilege of choosing that. Back in this time, rarely did you have the choice to choose which place you would work. If you chose to work there, you do a good job. And you honor and bless your employer, and you will find the blessing of God. Do you seek to conduct yourself, number three, with joy in Christ and thoughts of Christ in the continual, daily, mundane routine of life? This changes everything. Everything for the Christian matters. Everything. How you eat, how you drink, how you change diapers, how you wash the dishes, how you sweep the floor. It all is meaningful. Isn't that a delight? Knowing that God will use it in his sovereign plan, not just the big stuff. The preaching this morning was really important, right? How you sat and listened was really important. How you talked to one another was really important. How you got ready to come to church this morning was really important. And what you will do when you leave is really important. It's all really important. And then lastly, are you living your life in light of light of pleasing Christ at the judgment seat? The vast majority of your work will be that which is pleasing to him. And are you praying and rejoicing that your rewards for righteousness will redound to his glory? Let's pray. Father, thank you for our time. Thank you for the privilege of having your word and being reminded through Esther of the importance of even things like physical intimacy and the nature of who you've built us to be in light of these things. Father, I thank you also for all of these reminders of the importance of living in the world in a manner that pleases you. And that we would take the example of Mordecai and Esther, or knowing that it is you who strengthened and empowered them to be who they were, to be able to love our employers, to be able to live in our world in a way that is so different, so strikingly Christ-like, that the world would see that you are great. Lord, give us strength, give us grace, give us wisdom to do this as a congregation. In your precious name, amen.